à tous. Donc en fait, je suis par ici. Je vais être la modératrice pour la session à venir. Donc en fait, je vais vous introduire le premier intervenant, qui est donc le docteur Rob Herbert, qui nous vient d'Australie. En fait, il est physiothérapeute et il est chercheur donc au George Institute of International Health à Sydney. Donc on le connaît aussi pour le fait qu'il a été le créateur de la base de données Pedro. Et son CV est impressionnant, il est l'auteur de nombreux ouvrages et de nombreux articles scientifiques, notamment dans le cadre des essais cliniques. Donc je vais lui laisser la parole dès à présent.
Thank you, Angela. And good morning. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to present at this therapy conference. And I'd like to begin by thanking the Asian Journal for its time and invitation, both to present and for its hospitality since I arrived in France earlier this week. In this presentation, I want to discuss the process by which new therapies come to be introduced into clinical practice. And what I'm going to say, I think, is controversial, and I'm sure that some of the things I say, some of you will disagree. But I believe these things to be true, I think they're important, and I hope you consider what I have to say. I find it remarkable the inconsistency in the requirements for establishing a new therapy across the health professions. If a physician wants to administer a new drug, the physician can only administer the new drug if that drug has been subject to extensive and rigorous evaluation in randomized controlled trials. Some new drugs involve trials that cost tens of millions of euros, and unless those trials are conducted, a physician is not allowed to administer that drug. But there's no such requirement in physiotherapy, or surgery, or dentistry, or speech therapy, or podiatry, or any other area of health care. I've been thinking about this issue with a colleague, Professor Kari Bird from the Norwegian School of Sports Sciences in Oslo, and we wrote a paper. Together, we've written a paper titled "When and How Should New Therapies Become Routine Clinical Practice?" And this paper's to be published in the Physiotherapy Journal sometime in the next few months. We began our paper by referring to an older paper written by a distinguished epidemiologist, John McKinley, way back in 1981. McKinley wrote about his reflections on stages in the career of a medical innovation. I think he was largely writing about surgical innovations. He said that the typical medical innovation has the following life cycle. It begins with a promising report. A clever surgeon picks up a new surgical procedure or develops a new medical device and experiments with that in his surgical practice, or her surgical practice. And after a while, he or she decides to tell the colleagues, surgical colleagues, about this innovation. Soon, some of the most innovative surgeons are all practicing this method. They become opinion leaders that drive the rest of the profession. After a while, there's public acceptance. It may be that the public comes to learn about these innovative techniques. They may learn about it through media or through word of mouth, and they come to demand this of health professionals, of the surgeons. And sooner or later, most of the profession adopts this new innovation and it becomes standard practice. The practice becomes published in textbooks, recommended in textbooks, and all accepted
conservatives practice the intervention, practice the innovative therapy. But maybe sometime down the track, somebody decides to subject this new innovation, this new therapy, to a randomised controlled trial. And in McKinley's formulation, typically these randomised controlled trials produce negative results. They show that the innovation is not effective, and people begin to become disillusioned. After a period of time, there's a series of randomised trials with negative findings, and the profession begins to turn away from the innovation. And after all, there's been lots of other innovations in the meantime. There are other things to run across to, and eventually the profession abandons the innovation. And the innovation eventually becomes extinct, except that it still continues to appear in textbooks for as long as the paper exists. Now, McKinley's observations were about surgical practice, but I think it has a lot of resonance with the practice of physiotherapy. And his life cycle was offered in a slightly humorous way, but I think those of you who've practiced physiotherapy for any long period of time will recognise a grain of truth in the life cycle that we sometimes see physiotherapy practices as well. The turning point in McKinley's life cycle of a medical innovation is the randomised trial. And randomised trials hold a special place in research into the effectiveness of interventions. Randomised trials have come to be accepted as the only truly rigorous way of testing the effectiveness of an intervention. So let's have a look at a case study from the practice of physiotherapy. We know that stress urinary incontinence can be treated effectively with pelvic floor exercise. We have now over 50 randomised controlled trials that establish this fact. It's not a question. In 2001, an Australian physiotherapist, Ruth Saxon, performed a very interesting study, an electromyographic study, looking at the effects of contracting trunk stabilising muscles on the pelvic floor muscles. This was a difficult study to do, a technically demanding study that involved six women and one man with no history of low back pain, no history of incontinence. They used electromyography, put in very uncomfortable places, to examine the activity of the pelvic floor muscles. And they showed that when people perform strong contractions of their abdominal muscles, they elicited strong contractions of pelvic floor muscles. Subsequently, Sapsford has gone on to recommend that training of pelvic floor muscles should involve training of the abdominal muscles, the trunk stabilizing muscles. And so that's an example of an innovation that's based on some careful experimentation. Subsequently, a lot of therapists have taken this to extreme, and there are now, I believe, some therapists who train the pelvic floor muscles purely by training trunk stabilizing muscles. I'm not sure if that's fair to attribute that to Sapsford. So Sapsford's recommendations for innovation has been widely adopted, and it can be found in textbooks. But in 2004, we had the first randomised trial looking at training pelvic floor muscles or training abdominal muscles. This is a trial carried out by Dumoulin and colleagues. As part of a larger study, 44 women with stress urinary incontinence were randomised to groups which received either 8 weeks of pelvic floor rehabilitation or 8 weeks of pelvic floor rehabilitation with abdominal muscle training. At the end of the 8-week period, they evaluated the degree of incontinence in each of those two groups, and the important finding was that the absolute difference in the proportion of women whose incontinence was cured was about 4%, nearly 0%, a very small number. Another way of saying this is that for about one in every 25 women treated with the extra abdominal training, white mass, and condoms. But we can't rule out the possibility that they have no effect of the abdominal training. So at the moment, we have only one randomized trial that's directly evaluated the effectiveness of abdominal training for pelvic floor muscles. But the one fairly small trial, and not absolutely very inclusive trial, suggests that the abdominal training is not necessarily providing any additional benefit. So, some might say, what's the problem? This is what science is all about. We do studies, we learn new things, we change our mind. And I think that's absolutely true. But it seems to me that the problem we have here is that the process by which this new therapy entered practice was that the innovation preceded the evidence. And it would be better if new therapies were subjected to rigorous evaluation prior to being introduced to practice, prior to entering textbooks. Harry Burt and I have thought about what would be the optimum, the ideal way to introduce new innovations into physiotherapy practice. And we think that in this ideal world, things would happen in a six-step process. First of all, we have expert clinicians and perhaps clinician researchers who generate new ideas. Those new ideas might come from experimental work, or they might come from their clinical observations. Perhaps it's not where they come from. They then begin to explore those ideas by trying out new methods on patients, and perhaps with some of their close colleagues who are experts in the field, they might also try out those new methods. And if those early clinical experiments prove to be promising, they might go on to do pilot studies that formally test the feasibility of conducting this new innovative therapy. But the important thing is that this should be considered as a development phase. And I think in the ideal world, what would happen is that patients would be told that these are innovations that have not been subjected to rigorous evaluations. Patients should know when new therapies have been tried out. Another characteristic of this development phase would be that it's not disseminated widely. The ideas are kept to a small number of people, and the techniques are practiced in a small number of clinics. Subsequently, if the pilot testing proves sufficiently promising, then it's appropriate to conduct randomised controlled trials. Once there's sufficient prima facie evidence of the effectiveness of the intervention, then we can go to the enormous effort of conducting randomised controlled trials. And it's only after randomised trials have confirmed the effectiveness of the interventions that it's appropriate to introduce these new innovations into widespread clinical practice. It's only at that stage that it's appropriate for these innovations to appear in textbooks and to be talked about widely at conferences. Subsequently, there needs to be a refinement phase. In the refinement phase, further trials can be conducted to compare different ways of administering the intervention, to investigate what sorts of patients receive the optimal treatment effect, and to examine things like the cost effectiveness of the intervention. And somewhere late in that process, after the randomised trials have been conducted, then it's appropriate to have active dissemination to encourage the use of effective interventions by therapists. I think you'll agree that this is quite a different process to what happens in current clinical practice. So I'm sure many of you think this is unrealistic, this is inappropriate. Let me anticipate some of your objections. The first might be that we don't need to have randomised controlled trials. hard to do this. Randomised trials are an enormous undertaking. They have a long time to do. I'm just not going to get around to that. But I don't think that's sustainable either. We can now monitor fairly closely the production of randomised controlled trials in physiotherapy using the PEDRO database. The PEDRO database attempts to archive all of the randomised controlled trials in physiotherapy. And this graph shows the number of randomised controlled trials in physiotherapy and the cumulative randomised trials against the date of publication. Before 1960, there was only a handful of randomised trials in physiotherapy. But somewhere in the late 1980s or early 1990s, the production of randomised trials began to increase at a spectacular rate. The rate of increase of trials is exponential. It's doubling about every 4.5 years. That means that those of you who began practice as physiotherapists 10 years ago practiced at a time when there was less than 25% of the evidence that's currently available. We now have over 10,000 randomised controlled trials in physiotherapy, and if current trends continue, we expect that in 2009 there will be over 1,000 new randomised controlled trials. So we have the capacity to do this research. I think what we now need to focus on is doing it in a systematic way so that we can use new therapies optimally. And I think the last objection, perhaps the one that is likely to be held most widely, is that if we have to wait for randomised trials, we'll stifle innovation. We'll stop therapists being creative. We'll stop people coming up with new solutions for problems. And I'm sympathetic to that view. But I think we also need to consider the possibility that we may have too much innovation in physiotherapy. Maybe we have too much innovation and not enough evaluation. Perhaps it's more important to prevent widespread adoption of therapies that are effective than to permit the early adoption of new therapies. Once therapies enter clinical practice, it's very hard to remove them from clinical practice. So let me conclude by saying that we believe all new therapies should be rigorously evaluated with high quality randomised controlled trials, and that new therapies should not be advocated in workshops, at conferences such as this, professional journals, until randomised controlled trials have shown that the therapy is critically important.
Particularly randomised controlled trials in physiotherapy is difficult.
But with some effort, we do manage to get funding, and some of our trials are properly funded, which means that we can pay for research assistance to help with the collection of data. Sometimes we do randomised trials with no funding. Typically, these trials are done by PhD students who also have clinical practices, and they collect the data as part of their clinical practice. But this is very difficult, and of course it's much better to do it with funding. So we struggle for funding, sometimes we get it, and sometimes it makes it harder.
Une autre question assez rapide, si vous voulez.
There are other
by being strong about the use of evidence for new therapies. I think it's much harder when we have established therapies for which there's not strong evidence. It's a much more difficult question to know how to deal with those therapies. Obviously, we need those therapies to be subjected ultimately to randomised controlled trials. What we do with them in the meantime is a more difficult issue. But it seems to me that when we introduce new therapies, we should demand that we have randomised controlled trials before we introduce new therapies.
Okay,
thank
Donc on va remercier et donc ensuite on va enchaîner avec le docteur Anne Moreau.